Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from North Rim Bank, supporting news, educational, and cultural programming across the state on Alaska Public Media.
Americans lost a lot of money to fraud and scams in 2025, nearly $21 billion. And in Alaska, losses jumped by more than 50% last year to nearly $40 million, the highest ever in Alaska from cyber crimes. What's known about the rapid uptick in online theft, and what do you need to know to keep yourself safe? It's our discussion today on Talk of Alaska.
Alaska Public Media is now partnering with an Alaskan auction service so a helpful local team can get the biggest return for the least hassle should you decide to donate your vehicle. Learn more at alaskapublic.org/vehicle.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, from Alaska Public Media, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. There are lots of ways that cyber criminals attempt to defraud you and steal your identity and your money. The FBI reports that of the myriad types of scams, investment fraud, romance fraud, and business email compromise totaled more than $27 million in Alaska, more than half of the losses in our state last year. So what are these types of scams? How can you not get caught up in one? And what else do you need to know to protect yourself and your family members? Our guests today are here to help. Katie Severin is the Associate State Director of Communications for AARP in Alaska. Andy Smith is a supervisory special agent with the local Anchorage FBI office. And Ian Engelbeck is an attorney with the Alaska Attorney General's office working in the Consumer Protection Unit. Welcome, all of you. Thanks so much for being in studio today.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Lori.
It's great to have you here. Thank you. So, Andy, I want to start with you. The FBI release in April noted a 26% increase across the nation between 2024 and 2025, and a 52% increase in cybercrime in Alaska. What's known about why there has been such a huge increase?
I think it has a lot to do with scammers getting more and more proficient at learning how to gain the trust of their victims, mm-hmm. and the different techniques that they use in order to steal those victims' money.
Mm-hmm. Nearly 50% of the losses in Alaska were cryptocurrency related. What were some of the ways people got robbed through this type of online crime? I know nothing about cryptocurrency, and so I'm very, very unfamiliar with what could be happening there.
Yeah, and actually cryptocurrency is just a vehicle that the scammers use to steal money. It's one of many ways. They can, you know, traditionally it's wire transfers from a bank. We see gift cards being used, but cryptocurrency is increasingly becoming a tool of choice for scammers. It's very easy for victims to withdraw cash from their bank accounts and go to convenience stores, and there are cryptocurrency ATMs all around Alaska, and they can put that money in and it goes directly towards the scammers. But cryptocurrency in itself isn't the scam. It's just the vehicle that the scammers use to get the money. It is used by scammers across a variety of different types of scams and schemes.
And why do criminals like cryptocurrency? What is it about that they want to lean into?
I think it's, one, the ability to get the cash instantly. When you do a wire transfer, there's some delay and some ability also for the banks to potentially recall the transfer before it actually makes it into the hands of the scammers. Cryptocurrency, there is no such mechanism. It's an unregulated industry, and so when you put money into a cryptocurrency ATM and transfer it to somebody else's account, it is there instantly. I think there's also a perceived anonymity that comes with cryptocurrency. The scammers think that they have some cover if they use cryptocurrency, and that will be harder for law enforcement to track down. Not always the case. We're pretty good at tracking down cryptocurrency and tracing it through the various accounts.
This might be a silly question, but would any government or legitimate business ever ask for you to, hey, we want payment in cryptocurrency? Does that ever happen, or is it always, almost always a scam?
Well, I'm not going to speak for private industry. There very well may be businesses out there that accept crypto, but I will say that government institutions will not accept crypto as a form of payment for fees or to cover, you know, a bond or a bail amount. We don't accept crypto.
Okay. And Katie, I know that you are working with state lawmaker Republican Kathy Tilton on legislation to regulate crypto kiosks in Alaska. Talk about why this is needed and what that legislation seeks to do.
Well, you know, as Andy was talking about, cryptocurrency kiosks are much less regulated than traditional financial institutions. And so it can be very difficult at times to track where cryptocurrency goes once it's been fed into one of these cryptocurrency kiosks. There aren't warning signs on cryptocurrency kiosk machines that say, hey, this is a very common vehicle for scammers who are looking to receive payment. And so what we've been working with Senator Tilton to do is to increase the level of regulation around cryptocurrency kiosks. It's not beyond what we see in traditional financial institutions. It would just raise the bar so that those kiosks are regulated to a standard that would allow us to feel more confident and safer in using them.
Mm-hmm. And Ian, or Andy, are you aware of other legislative attempts to try and regulate some of this? Because it's such a new and emerging area of payment. Mm-hmm. Are there state or federal lawmakers looking to address this type of crime?
Well, I mean, there were several bills in the Alaska State Legislature this session, but there's also bills in many states going on right now. And a number of states have banned these kiosks outright.
Oh, interesting. Oh, okay. So some states are not even allowing them at all. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska. And today we're talking about the rise in online fraud and scams. In the studio, we have Katie Severin, who is the Associate State Director of Communications for AARP Alaska. Ian Engelbeck is an attorney with the Attorney General's Office in the Consumer Protection Unit. And Andy Smith is a Supervisory Special Agent with the Anchorage FBI Office. Let's go to the phones for a moment. Joe he's in Alaska somewhere. Hi, Joe. Joe, are you there? Well, Joe is in Alaska, I guess, but he's not on the line right now. We did have an email from Amelia and Steve that says, curious if any scammers have been caught and what they have to say about what they do to people. I suppose some scammers have been caught. I don't know. Is there anything you'd want to say about that?
Yeah, absolutely. We do have success at catching these criminals. I mean, it is, as you mentioned earlier, the numbers are prolific. They're alarming. They're concerning. They're record-breaking every single year. And so there's a lot of work to be done. But we are successful in holding people accountable. We've held people accountable right here in Alaska who have participated in these scams. We also see scammers all across the U.S. and unfortunately a lot of scammers overseas as well. But the FBI is kind of uniquely situated to attack and go after even those actors that are overseas. We have agents in nearly 100 countries all over the world that work locally in those countries with local law enforcement. And we do have absolutely success at shutting down some of these big prolific scammers and holding them accountable, getting them arrested.
I read this is sort of an aside, but I read an interesting NPR article the other day about there's been a crackdown in some Asian countries with scamming and fraud, that there have been people that were trafficked into those jobs and forced labor into those jobs, and then they just get cut loose, and now there they are, kind of homeless and wandering the streets. So shutting down one problem has created another in some areas. So that was an interesting note that I hadn't thought about, the fact that people may be doing this not because they want to, but because they're being forced to. Katie, you had mentioned this type of scam, and I'm really glad to get this in front of all of you. Call scams seeking to record your voice. And I've heard different variations of does this really happen? How does this work? When you say hello, is anyone there? Your voice can get recorded, then cloned, and a call comes in allegedly from a family member in trouble. Describe how this works and how people can avoid it. I saw something online about it, and I thought, okay, so when you answer the phone and you don't recognize the number, don't say anything. Just wait till they say something. But that's weird and awkward, too.
It is, Lori. And I think this is one of many questions that are arising and will continue to arise related to artificial intelligence and the use of AI in scams. The technology is changing so rapidly that it is difficult to know what we can trust. And the easiest way that I can tell you and that I would tell our listeners to circumvent these types of scams is to not answer the phone when it's an unknown number. If it is something important, they will leave a voicemail. You can also look up, copy the phone number that you see on your screen. You can look at, plug it into Google and look it up. Many, many times I have done this and it comes up as, this is a scammer. This is a scam phone number. And so to your point about these scams, what we're talking about are scams where you would answer the phone. It would be a phone call from an unknown number. You might say, hello, hello, is anyone there? And in that moment, a recording is being made of your voice that then can be used with the artificial intelligence to create a longer message that sounds like it is coming from someone you know. And so that enables scammers to target friends and family members by creating a message that sounds like it is legitimate. So again, the best way to circumvent a scam like that is to not answer the phone when you receive a phone call from an unknown number. Andy or Ian?
And I totally agree with Katie. And I would say that if by chance you accidentally do answer a phone and your voice does get recorded, one of the most important tips that we try to tell people is if you ever do get a phone call like this from a family member claiming to be in some sort of distress, either a car accident or under arrest or some sort of significant event that they need help and they need fast cash, we tell people, as hard as it may be to hang up the phone. They are going to try so hard to keep you on the phone, because the longer they keep you on the phone, the more likely they are to convince you that what this is real and to steal your money. So hang up the phone and call back the person that is purportedly calling you. Call back your family member on a known and trusted number that you initiate contact with. And 99% of the time, it's going to be totally fine. Your family member is fine. There's no issue, and then you can verify whether what's going on is true or not.
Mm-hmm. Ian?
Well, I think that's also a reason that people need to think carefully about what they put on social media. I mean, these scammers are calling up trying to get a recording of your voice. But of course, a lot of people put recordings of their voice on social media.
I was going to mention that. I mean, my voice is, there's hours of my voice online. Yep. I don't want to let the scammers think about those things, but yes, social media, videos, audio, it's all over the place.
Yeah, and that's one of the things we've seen is that scammers will take public figures and family members of public figures are vulnerable to these types of scams because there's lots of good, high-quality recordings of their voices out there.
Yeah. I was thinking about that last night, like, oh no, it doesn't even matter if I don't answer the phone or not. And it's amazing how, as I've gotten older, I'm increasingly popular with all of these phone numbers popping up from all over the country. I don't answer them. And most of the time, they don't leave messages. But it is amazing to me how I will see numbers from a lot of different states or rural Alaska. Sometimes there's numbers that they are masking, I guess, in rural Alaska. How does that work?
Well, I think, so they'll spoof numbers, and generally what you'll see is a number coming into your phone that matches the area code of the number that you have, because the scammers believe if you see a local number, you're more likely to answer that. Just be very careful. And if I could take just a second to add on a little bit more for this artificial intelligence problem, because it is a growing problem. It's a tool that scammers absolutely are taking advantage of, not only to clone voices and match voices of loved ones, but they also do deep fake videos. And you can go online and see examples of these deep fake videos with celebrities and political individuals, and they are very realistic. AI has come a long way, and it is very convincing. And so one of the things that scammers will do is when they're you know, conditioning a potential victim and trying to gain that trust, they may do a video call. Because if you see that person on video, maybe you're more apt to trust that they are who they say they are, but they can do deep fakes and they can match and look like any person in the world, any accent in the world. So we see AI being used for deep fake videos. We also see it being used a lot to produce very convincing and realistic official documents, court documents, arrest warrants, things like that. So they can actually send their victims these very official looking documents that are all generated from AI.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, the hits just keep coming. Let's go back to the phones. Joe, are you there?
Yes. Couple observations. Number one, my battery died in the phone, so I asked someone to call my wife for me and who was next to me, and they did, but she wouldn't pick up because she didn't recognize the number. So, guys, it's not funny, though, if you think about it. I mean, people help each other. And
yeah, you're right. Sorry.
It doesn't work because we're all paranoid. And I am very paranoid. I still pay by check. All my bills go through the mail. And when I look at my account at the bank, I see all these numbers for every transaction. And I can't say where these were. You know, you look at your statement and it's numbers. It doesn't say Costco or Fred Meyers. So this is very concerning. And if I have to buy online, I will go to the bank the very next day and destroy my debit card. And they'll issue a new one right there. Hmm. So anyhow, I'm paranoid, obviously, but do these efforts help? Also, I have a password on my account. Even when I go into the bank, they ask me my password, regardless of my ID information. And it takes extra time. But, you know, AI, I got friends from the Russian community that say it's just a matter of time before everything gets hacked. So, yeah, are my efforts going to help me out? That's my question.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Joe, for the question. I also still pay bills by check. I mean, I pay some with a credit card, but I still send out checks. And Joe's question about having a password, you know, taking those extra steps, what would you say about those security things? Ian?
I mean, passwords are great, but of course, we've all seen news stories about companies having data breaches, right? Hackers are able to access the company's data. They're able to get usernames and passwords. And what they'll often do after getting these usernames and passwords is start plugging them through other companies because people reuse the same username and password. That's why you constantly hear this advice, you know, have different passwords for everything. This is why. But the thing that people could do to most protect their online accounts is set up two-factor authentication. So that means you go and you try to log in, and the next thing that happens, especially, you know, banks will usually have this, you'll get a text and you'll have a code from that text that you've then got to plug back in. That's a really important tool for protecting your online accounts.
Mm-hmm. I have one of my credit cards I have set up where I get a text alert if there's a charge of $100 or higher. But I've realized maybe I should lower that because I just read an article about a woman who had 1,700 charges on a card. It's $2.19 to $5 about at an Apple store. And had to fight to get that reversed. She clearly didn't make all these, but because she had made some other Apple purchases, the bank was like, well, I don't know, you made some of these purchases. So it was multiple thousands of dollars, and she ended up, you know, having to fight this for a very long time to get it reversed. So that two-factor authentication is a really good idea to get a text alert or an email alert to your account so that you can make sure that you're safe. What about paying by check? Is mail still okay?
So unfortunately, everything is potentially vulnerable to attack or to scammers. We have absolutely seen people steal mail out of mailboxes, find checks, wash the checks, rewrite them for different amounts and to different individuals, and then cash those checks. So checks can absolutely be vulnerable. Debit cards can be vulnerable. Credit cards can be vulnerable. Any method of payment can be exploited by scammers in the right circumstances. So I agree with Ian. Two-factor authentication is super important. Joe, it sounds like you're on your account and reviewing your charges regularly, which is another thing I highly recommend, is make sure on an extremely regular basis you're on there and looking for any fraudulent accounts. And as soon as you, fraudulent charges, and as soon as you notice anything, make sure you're reaching out to your financial institution, because they can help you investigate that and potentially get your money recovered. Of all forms of payment, probably the one that has the most consumer protections is credit cards. I'm not advocating for the use of credit cards. Sure. I'm just saying that generally they have better consumer protections for fraud alerts and things like that. But anything can be vulnerable for attack and exploited by scammers. So use strong passwords, change them regularly, use two-factor authentication, and make sure you're getting on your account on a regular basis to make sure that the charges are charges that you initiated.
The debit card situation, I tend to not use that. I used it a lot for a while. I thought, yay, I'm going to get rid of all my credit cards. And then a friend of mine said, you know, that's a direct line into your bank account, right? So if somebody scams you, they could drain your entire bank account. Not that I have tons of money in my bank account, but still, I hadn't thought about that lack of protection with a debit card. So I went back to using credit cards for most things. But now I realize that some businesses are starting to charge for that 3% charge on credit cards too. So now I'm trying to decide, is it a good idea to set up a debit card with a separate account, maybe, where you just have a little bit of money in there and it's not your main account, so that you could use a debit card without at least so much risk? There's just so many different ways that people can come at you for these things. Andy, yeah, go ahead.
And if I could just add one more thing, and this, if Joe, if you're still on the line, like one thing that I would recommend you do, and all of the callers and listeners today, is go onto the FBI's website, ic3.gov, the letter I, the letter C, and the number 3.gov. There are a whole host of tips and tricks and best practices that you can implement in your daily life to help avoid becoming a victim. So please check out that website and review those best practices.
We'll make sure to link to that with the Talk of Alaska post today, so folks can find that there. Andy, I wanted to have us sort of walk through the fraud crimes identified by the FBI release, starting with investment fraud. What are criminals asking for in these types of crimes, and what type of accounts are they trying to drain?
They will drain any and all accounts that you give them access to. But the idea behind this, it's terrifying, and it's extremely prolific right now and growing every year. Investment scams are going to start. Most of these scams, there's going to be some sort of trust building that needs to be involved. Whether it's a law enforcement impersonation scam, a romance scam, an investment, the scammers need you to trust them to some degree, whether that's through fear, whether that's through emotion, whether that's through any other mean. If they want you to send them money, you have to feel some sort of trust with them. And so they're going to go through a trust building phase with you and eventually talk about how their investments are doing really well. And that if you're interested, they can hook you up with their, you know, uncle or their financial advisor, and you can get these amazing guaranteed returns. And so what we tell people, one, is anybody that you have only met online, regardless of how sad of a story they tell you, how compelling of an investment opportunity it is, do your own individual and independent research online. You are responsible for your money. Before you send money to anywhere, even if it's not through somebody you've met online, do your homework and make sure that what you're looking at and what you're investing in is a legitimate thing. But generally speaking, if somebody that you solely met online is asking for money for whatever reason, it's a scam. Do not send money to people that you solely know through online means.
Yeah, and you know, the difficulty there, of course, is there's so much commerce that gets done online. I know that when I was about 4 or 5 years ago, I was looking to refinance my house, and I was going to go back through the bank that I've been using locally for a long time because I like being able to meet face-to-face with people. And my son said, oh, Mom, go online. You'll get a much better rate with one of the online. I'm like, really? I don't want to put all that information out there. Well, I ended up with a much better interest rate. So there's some give and take there. But it does take a lot of research to make sure that you're really connected with, even though I did all the process online, they sent someone to my house, a notary to my house, to go through documents and things. So, you know, that helped me feel like, yeah, this is legitimate. Mm-hmm. Yes, Ian.
You know, one of the things we always recommend is if you're online and you're looking at buying something or a service and you're not familiar with the website and maybe the deal seems too good to be true, just type in the name of that website and scam into the search bar. Generally, people who have had bad experiences with that website are going to be loud about it, and oftentimes that'll save people a lot of grief.
All right, that's a good thing to also know, is that you can do your own research, and really you should take extra steps to make sure, as Andy said, if you're only interacting with someone online, really hard to know if that's legitimate or not. Do people usually get funds back, or do they usually not?
It's a great question. So I mentioned our website, ic3.gov. That stands for the Internet Crime Complaint Center. Mm-hmm. And that is a website that the FBI hosts. It is a central repository where we want the whole nation to go and report anytime they've been victimized by any sort of scam. One of the many advantages and things that IC3 does is if you engage in a wire transfer, and as soon as you hit send, you realize you've made a mistake. And we hear stories like this all the time. If you can get onto IC3 within about 2 to 3 days of sending that funds, there's a greater than not chance we can get those funds recovered on the front end.
Oh, wow.
On the back end, it's much more challenging because scammers don't hold on to your money. They're not sitting there with a ginormous bank account. They're spending your money and living the good life. Mm-hmm. So really, the way we can get it on the back end is to seize assets or potentially seize accounts that do have some money, but it's going to be, you know, it's not going to be the full amount. And so the front end is better, and prevention is the best, which is why we're here, and we appreciate, again, your giving us this platform.
Yeah, well, there's a lot more to talk about, and we will continue this discussion on how to keep yourself safe from online fraud and scams after this break, as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Alaska Public Media is all about community. Wear your community on your sleeve with the purchase of branded clothes and collectibles from our online store. Visit alaskapublic.org/shop.
Let's go back to the phones. Margaret is in Nome. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. Thank you for hosting this show. I'm calling because about a year ago, I serve on the board of a local nonprofit. We discovered that $1,000 had been withdrawn from our checking account through an ACH transfer, and it turns out that the bank deemed us a business, even though we're a local nonprofit, and one has only 3 days to contest an unauthorized ACH transfer. We were positive that it was unauthorized because it was for, the bill actually came from Intuit for online tax preparation services, and we use a local accountant. We were certain that it had nothing to do with us. But it actually took me about 3 months to get the money refunded. The local bank said that because we had notified them within 5 days instead of 3 days, that we were not eligible for any assistance from them. I did do the IC3 thing. I don't think I ever heard back from that. I contacted the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and I believe it must have been their response that ultimately led to us getting the refund. But it took an awful lot of work, and it was a very time-consuming and frustrating process. And I know consumers have 60 days to contest these, but I assume the banks believe that somebody is sitting there monitoring the account data every day for even nonprofits with no staff. So I'm curious as to whether ACH has proven to be another form of fertile ground for scammers, and whether we see that in Alaska or whether anybody knows anything about it nationwide.
All right. Thank you, Margaret. Sorry you had that experience. But, you know, it's another reason why checking your account frequently is really, I look at mine every day because I want to make sure everything looks like it should. So I check all the time. Katie, I saw you nodding a bit as Margaret was talking about this ACH problem.
You know, I was thinking about, I've served on a couple local boards, and local boards are a very fertile ground for scammers because board members are often published online. And so it's easy for scammers to spoof the identity of board members. And so you might receive what looks like an email from the president of your board asking for a financial transaction or for gift cards, which is something that a board that I'm a part of has experienced in the past. And it looks very legitimate. In fact, it looks like it's coming from the president of the board, the treasurer of the board. But it's not. But that information, as we talked about with social media and video on, and photos on social media, is published online. So it's readily available, and it makes for a great opportunity for a scam to happen. Andy, what do you know about ACH scams in particular?
Yeah, we certainly see, as I've said earlier, any option that a scammer has to steal your money, they're going to find ways to exploit it. So we do see people getting account information and doing ACH transfers, absolutely. And I'm so glad that you went on to IC3 and reported that. And I apologize you didn't get a call back. Unfortunately, we get so many reports, we're not able to individually call back every single complainant. But everything is logged, everything is looked at, and there is communication that goes back and forth on the back end with financial institutions in many cases. And I am glad you got your money back, and I know it's an arduous process. But I'm glad you stuck with it and were able to get the funds back. I would just echo kind of some of the similar things that we've said earlier, is make sure you're logging into the account as frequently as possible and verifying those charges, because scammers are out there and they're getting more and more skilled, and they're using every single method that they can to steal your money. And so we have to be very vigilant, and prevention is absolutely the most important thing. So now that you've had this experience, I hope that you take advantage and make sure you share what happened and how you got your money back with all the people in your organization, so they know what to be on the lookout for and how to address it if something else comes up.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Margaret. That's a really interesting experience. ACH is very common to be using that type of transfer. Ian, how does the Consumer Protection Unit that you're part of work with Alaskans for things such as Margaret just described?
Well, the Consumer Protection Unit takes in consumer complaints anytime an Alaskan feels like they've been treated unfairly or been subject to a deceptive practice from a business. They can send in complaints to us, and we'll work through a consumer complaint process with that business. For folks who complain about a scam, who have been victimized by a scam, we send them to our colleagues at the FBI. IC3 is a great resource for Alaskans.
Yes.
And if I could add just one more thing onto the IC3, as you mentioned at the beginning of the show, there were over nearly $21 billion in losses reported by Americans all across the country. We received more than 1 million individual submissions of complaints, and that is only what we're getting. We believe this is a far underreported number because a lot of people have embarrassment. They don't want to talk to their family about it. They don't want to go on and report that they've been victimized. They're ashamed of it, and there's no reason to be ashamed. These scammers are incredibly skilled. They are very proficient at what they do, and so there really is no need to feel embarrassed. I know it can be extremely heartbreaking, but please go on and report. And even though I mentioned like 1 million individual complaints, that we can't individually contact every single person, but IC3 does a lot of things on the back end. I mentioned the communication with financial institutions, but one of the other really cool things that it does is it aggregates all of the data. And so, you know, Margaret lost $1,000, significant loss. she's probably not the only person that lost money to that scammer. And so it's really important that consumers, even though you may not get a call back, go on to IC3 and report it, because that $1,000, if she put an account number, you know, where the money was transferred to, IC3 is looking at all of those million complaints, and it's going to find every other complaint that had money transferred to that account, or that was contacted through that email address or that text message phone number. And it's going to link all of those together so that we as the FBI can identify who are the most problematic and prolific scammers all across the world, so that we can triage and go after those that are causing the most harm to the most Americans.
Mm-hmm. We have an email note from Rich in Juneau. Rich says, we have alerting systems on our cards, as I was referencing. And while we were on vacation, we were notified of what turned out to be some fraudulent charges. The credit card company dealt with it immediately and reversed the charges, but their solution was to cancel our card and told us it would be 5 to 7 business days to get a replacement. There was no way to get a temporary card. He says, fortunately, we keep 2 cards active and we were able to use our alternate card in the meantime. Otherwise, it would have been a real problem. Probably good advice for when you're traveling to make sure that you've got more than one method of paying in case something like that happens. I wanted to ask about some of the other identified crimes. One of them, of the categories that is big, is confidence or romance scams. What are the distinctions between the two? Or are they kind of the same?
So confidence or romance, yeah, they are generally kind of coupled into the same thing. In fact, a subcategory of that crime problem is those grandparent scams, so those family member scams that we talked about. And the idea behind a confidence and romance scam is, again, there's going to be a trust building phase that the scammer is going to go through with their victims. And honestly, we've seen that trust develop over days and maybe even take up to a year. These scammers are dedicated and will invest the time in developing that relationship of trust with their victims. But what distinguishes like investment scam versus confidence and romance scams is in the confidence and romance scams, there's going to be some sort of tragedy. There's going to be some sort of really heartbreaking event that happens, quote unquote, happens to the scammer, that they're going to communicate to their potential victim and try to tug at the heartstrings and the good nature of the people of Alaska and the people of America, and hope that they want to help them out and send them money to solve whatever problem they've come up with. It can be medical bills to pay for cancer treatment. It can be maybe they're in trouble with the law and they need money for bail. I tell you, we have seen the whole gamut of stories that these scammers come up with, but they will always ask for money, and it will always be related to some sort of tragic event that's happened in the, quote unquote, that has happened in the scammer's life.
The IC3 website, is that some place where you can go and say, hey, I got a text message from this number that was clearly a scam attempt? Can you register those numbers there as well?
You can go on and report that. Okay. I will say that there's a lot of information that needs to be put into the IC3. So please feel free to go and do that. I personally get spam emails and text messages on a relatively regular basis, as I'm sure most of us do. So to go on every single time, you may or may not have time to do that. One thing you can always do, though, is there's the modern phones, they have a little button that says report as spam or report as a scam. Mm-hmm. If you click that button, I'm sure all of us have gotten calls that say spam risk or scam alert. That is because somebody got a call from them and they clicked that button, and the telephone company has now logged that number as a problematic number. So anybody else on their network that gets a call from that number, they're alerted.
Oh,
so that's something I would recommend.
That's really
to do
helpful
as well.
To know, because I do that if I get. But I also, and I wanted to ask for advice about this, because this is something that my son gets mad at me for, is I will mess with them. If they send me, I got one that said, this is your boss, Ed Ullman, and I need you to send me some gift cards. I'm at a conference. And I knew immediately, it was a number I didn't recognize. Of course, I know my CEO's number, and he wouldn't send me a text saying, this is your boss, Ed Ullman. So I knew immediately it was some not highly sophisticated scammer. But I played along for a while. I was like, okay, I'll drive to the Apple store and get these cards, and just kept it up for about an hour. And then the person said, what's happening? Why is it done yet? And I said, well, it takes me a while to drive to the store. And Then after a while, I just finally said, okay, I know you're not my boss. And let's see, you were trying to extort me for so many thousands of dollars. So now I'm going to report you to the FBI. And then, of course, they quit responding. But my son said, Mom, you shouldn't do that. They might hook you somehow. And I'm like, I feel like as long as I keep them on the line, they're not bothering someone else. But I don't know. What are your thoughts about doing things like that?
Well, I mean, anecdotally, it does seem like the more you engage with these scam numbers, the more you get.
Interesting.
But I think it's important to remember with scammers, these guys are professionals. They're doing it day in, day out. They're scamming people who were sure they were never going to get scammed. The safest way to deal with scammers is to not engage with them.
Okay.
Well. And once you answered, right, they know they have a live number. Mm-hmm. So they, as Ian said, can retarget you. And the way I like to think of scams is we think of some people as being more vulnerable to scams than others. That's really not true. There is a scam for every person. So that scammer did not get you with that scam, but they learned something about you. That scam will not work. Maybe I'll try another one. I do have a live phone number that's going to reach Lori. So they're learning something when you engage with them. So anytime we talk about that, we would advise not engaging with these people or limiting it as much as possible. Let's say you pick up the phone, but also you realize that it's a scam later. You can always end that phone call or end the interaction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I will not say anything further because I totally agree with Katie and Ian.
Oh, darn it. It's kind of fun to mess with them, but I'll stop. All right. Casey is on the line from Anchorage. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Great show. Yeah, I read an article about a year ago in a local publication that had to do with identity theft, and some of it talked about then taking out a second mortgage on your house, and in some cases, people losing their house. And one of the things they said you could do is freeze your credit, and which I get. Anyway, I'll leave it at that and see what you have to say.
Thank you, Casey. I'm really glad that you called with that question because, you know, several years ago when one of the big three credit rating agencies got hacked into and there was a lawsuit and a big mess, and then the result of that lawsuit was that you were able to lock your credit for free. It used to cost, which seemed a little weird to me, like, I have to pay so you can't see my credit, but now it's free. So I've locked mine. I don't need any more credit cards. I don't need another mortgage. So my credit's locked. What are the thoughts about that?
Great idea.
Yep.
Yeah. Freeze your credit.
Totally agree. Free service. It's very easy to unfreeze it temporarily if you need to, yep, take out another mortgage. But yeah, I love the idea.
Yeah, I agree. So if you're not looking to refinance your house, or even if you are, you can keep your credit locked until you need to do that. Unlock it, refinance, lock it back up, and then you don't have to worry. People can't see your credit or any of your accounts or anything. Is that correct? So that they can't even look and...
Nor can they even open a new account if it's locked, yeah.
Yeah, I love it. All right, we are going to take another quick break. We'll come back and continue our discussion about how to keep yourself safe from online scams as Talk of Alaska continues. In the studio with me today is Katie Severin. Katie is the Associate State Director of Communications for AARP Alaska. Ian Engelbeck is an attorney in the Attorney General's Office with the Consumer Protection Unit. And Andy Smith is a Supervisory Special Agent with the Anchorage FBI Office. Before the break, we had a caller asking about freezing credit, which we all agreed is a really great idea. Lock your credit. Don't let anybody see it. And there's also places where you can register online to not get credit card solicitations. I don't get them now because my credit's locked. But boy, I've hated getting those in the mail because my mailbox is out by the street. Anybody could walk by and open it at any time. And so I would worry about those. I always shredded those. And my mom, many, many years ago, had, oh gosh, probably 30 years ago, I went to visit her one time and she had a little shredder. And I said, Mom, what are you shredding? You got secret documents? I thought it was hilarious. And she said, I shred any kind of credit card offers or anything like that that comes in. And I thought it was so silly at the time because I just thought, oh gosh, you know. But I realize now she was really smart to do that, not to just toss them in the recycling or something. So being careful about all of those things, even my utility bills, I will shred the, you know, the bill that comes in after I've paid it to make sure that none of that goes someplace where somebody could get an account in your name. The FBI's Internet Crime Report for 2024 found Alaskans lost $26 million, which was down from 2023. But now this big swing up. Is there just more people setting these scam operations up, or are they getting more sophisticated at it? What's the thinking there?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of many factors. I think the increased use of artificial intelligence is one of the driving factors. The increased use of cryptocurrency and the ease at which scammers can move money around is another factor. And there are just kind of up and down swings. The overall trend is up, though, like you said. I mean, if we look at the last 10 years of Alaskan losses, we're at like $158 million in the last 10 years. Over 25% of that came from last year alone. So it is dramatically increasing, which is why we try to do as much of this outreach and educate the public as we possibly can, because prevention is absolutely the most important thing.
In my mind, too, Andy, hopefully part of that increase is an increase in people reporting. And I think that is part of why the three of us are sitting and talking with you today, Lori, is that the more that we can talk about fraud and its prevalence and try to reduce some of the stigma and the shame around being defrauded, the more that people will report these things, which has really a big impact on, for example, Andy and his team's ability to go forward with the law enforcement process as it relates to these crimes. We really need to know what's going on in order to pursue these criminals. And I see Ian nodding as well.
Yeah. Yes, please, Ian.
Oh, I think it's important to remember that we're all vulnerable to these scams. I mean, scammers play on psychological tricks that we are all potentially vulnerable to.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually pretty interesting. If you look at the FTC's data, the Federal Trade Commission's data on scam reports, the age groups that report scams the most are people from their 20s to their 40s. There's actually fewer reports coming in from older folks, though those folks are reporting that they got scammed for more money. Now, I mean, is there something to do with like who's more willing to report a scam? It could well be. Mm. But I mean, it's important to remember that like there's no age group that's invulnerable to scams here.
That is really interesting, because I had an assumption that it was that the highest percentages would be in a population my age, older folks, instead of younger folks. But I suppose younger people are online a lot more too, so maybe that's part of it.
Yeah, you can see a difference in the types of scams that people end up getting victimized by. Younger folks are more likely to fall prey to like an online shopping scam.
Okay. All right, let's go back to the phones. John is in Kodiak. Hi, John.
Hey. I live on Kodiak, and I was in Anchorage visiting my family. I got a call from the Kodiak Police Department. There was a warrant for my arrest because there was registered mail sent to my place. And somebody signed for it that wasn't me. And so all they told me was just go down to the Anchorage Police Department and verify your signature. Okay, no problem. But before I go down, I got to post bail so I don't get arrested there. Okay, so then they said go to a Bitcoin machine to post bail. Okay. So I did that. I'm, for $1,000, I'm putting in the last $100, and I'm going like, this has got to be a scam. But the way they hit you is like, I said, okay, if you don't have the money for the bond, you can, file a hardship report, a financial hardship report. So the psychology involved in it, you know, and I said, yeah, I got the money, you know, so they're so sneaky. And like a lot of the callers you've had, oh, I don't get scammed. Yeah, I've had rental property and everything else, but God, just the psychology involved in it. And I called Bitcoin after that. Of course, I went to the police department. Nobody was there. And I talking to an officer there, and he said, you got scammed. And so I went to Bitcoin, and they were supposed to reimburse me. They sent me a check. I don't know if it's phony or not. But I just tell your people there, you know, people listening, that you think you're so smart, they will hit you in the gut where you do not think they're going to hit you. And how did they know I was in Anchorage? That's what scares me. So I hope people listen to this and realize they will get you. No matter how smart you think you are, they will figure a way. So that's all I got. So I hope it helps somebody.
Yes, thank you, John. It's so important for folks to share those experiences and not be embarrassed by them, because John's absolutely right. It could happen to anyone. And the fact that they even said, oh, well, if you have a hardship, offering to give you an out, which makes it sound, well, this must be legitimate, right? They're saying I don't have to pay if I have a hardship. So, wow. Andy.
I'm so glad that he called. And this is a huge problem that we are seeing increasingly numbers, specifically in the last year and a half, related to these law enforcement scams. And they are incredibly sophisticated. Like you said, everything they say is designed to make it seem very, very legitimate. And one of the things that they'll do as well is, because one of the tips that we always tell people is hang up the phone and call back. Like if they're calling from and claiming to be from the FBI, which we've seen, let them know, I want to verify who you say you are. I'm going to hang up and call the FBI and ask to be transferred to you. They have gone to the point of telling their victims, if you hang up the phone, you will face additional charges of obstruction, because they know as soon as you get off the phone and call, the whole thing falls apart. But if they can keep you on the phone by threatening additional charges, additional fees, they're going to have more success. So they're extremely sophisticated. It is a huge scare tactic. And I'm so glad that he mentioned too, like we all kind of think that we should be above this. Like I do this for a living. I tell my family members about these types of things all the time. And I've had family members fall for these law enforcement scams. I know lots of people that I deal with on a daily basis when I do these presentations that call me and they're like, I just nearly fell for this, or I almost fell for this. They're very, very good. So yeah, please be careful.
Yes, thank you for the call. We're almost out of time, but let's go to another phone call here quickly. Georgia is in North Pole. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, can you tell us quickly what's going on? We're running out of time.
Okay. So really quickly, my adult son and I wanted to start an online business. So we came across this company that said, we will help you open an online store. We'll help you find products to sell, and we'll get you all set up. And they called me. We talked for like 3 hours, and it sounded like it was pretty legitimate. Then they called again. They wanted $4,000 to set this stuff up. They sent me a contract to sign that said, yeah, they would help me with all this stuff. And so I sent them the $4,000, charged it to a charge card. And then it took a couple more weeks of them walking me through stuff. Ultimately, what it was is that they opened up a Spotify store for me that... then I was going to have to pay monthly fees for the store. But then the products that they gave me is they took me to another site that had discounted Chinese products that I was to take and go through. I had to remove any foreign languages, any mention of where it was made, any... thing, and I had to kind of design it.
And Georgia, did you get your money back? Store. Did you end up getting your money back?
No.
Oh, I'm very sorry to hear that. And I'm sorry that we're out of time here. So I wish that call would have came in a little earlier. We also had an email asking about scam texts and should they report them. Yes, please do report those, because then those numbers get flagged. Thanks so much to our guest today, Katie Severin, Associate State Director of Communications with AARP Alaska. Thanks to Ian Engelbeck, an attorney in the Attorney General's Office with the Consumer Protection Unit, and Andy Smith, is a supervisory special agent with the Anchorage FBI office. We will link on our Talk of Alaska website to the ic3.gov and some other links. Thanks to our engineer, Crystal Hyde. Our producer is Emily Mester. Our editor is Annie Feit. On the phones, Ava White helped us out. I'm Laurie Townsend. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.